That's chapter 23, starting at verse 1. Sarah lived for 127 years. These were the years of the life of Sarah. And Sarah died at Kiriath Arba, that is, Hebron, in the land of Canaan. And Abraham went in to mourn for Sarah and to weep for her. And Abraham rose up from before his dead and said to the Hittites, I am a sojourner and a foreigner among you. Give me property among you for a burying place, that I may bury my dead out of my sight. The Hittites answered Abraham, Hear us, my lord. You are a prince of God among us. Bury your dead in the choicest of our tombs. None of us will withhold from you his tomb to hinder you from burying your dead. Abraham rose and bowed to the Hittites, the people of the land. And he said to them, If you are willing that I should bury my dead out of my sight, hear me and entreat for me Ephron, the son of Zohar, that he may give me the cave of Machpelah, which he owns. It is at the end of his field. For the full price, let him give it to me in your presence as property for a burying place. Now Ephron was sitting among the Hittites, and Ephron the Hittite answered Abraham in the hearing of the Hittites, all who went in at the gate of his city. No, my lord, hear me. I give you the field, and I give you the cave that is in it. In the sight of the sons of my people, I give it to you. Bury your dead. Then Abraham bowed down before the people of the land. And he said to Ephron in the hearing of the people of the land, But if you will, hear me. I give the price of the field. Accept it from me, that I may bury my dead there. Ephron answered Abraham, My lord, listen to me. A piece of land worth 400 shekels of silver. What is that between you and me? Bury your dead. Abraham listened to Ephron, and Abraham weighed out for Ephron the silver that he had named in the hearing of the Hittites, 400 shekels of silver, according to the weights current among the merchants. So the field of Ephron in Machpelah, which was set to the east of Mamre, the field with the cave that was in it, and all the trees that were in the field throughout its whole area was made over to Abraham as a possession in the presence of the Hittites, before all who went in at the gate of his city. After this, Abraham buried Sarah, his wife, in the cave of the field of Machpelah, east of Mamre, that is, Hebron, in the land of Canaan. The field and the cave that is in it were made over to Abraham as property for a burying place by the Hittites.
Thanks so much, Jess. Thank you, Andrew. Do keep Bibles open, Genesis 23. The reading is also on the inside of your service sheet, and that might be a help to you because it's got some headings as well, which we're going to look at. Just by show of hands, who has listened to a sermon or done a Bible study before on Genesis 23? Anyone? Yeah, two hands. Okay, well, that's two more than I certainly haven't. So the rest of you, you're in good company with me because this was new to me this month. This is one of the great benefits, isn't it, of doing consecutive study through the Bible. So we've been going bit by bit through Genesis. The last Genesis sermon was Genesis 22, so this one's Genesis 23. It means that we hit bits of the Bible that we might not have chosen if we were doing it otherwise. And this is a bit of the Bible all about the clarity that death can bring. So we've been looking at the life of Abraham, and this is the part of his life where his wife, age 127, dies, and it brings a clarity to him. And this isn't unique to Christians. Lots of people describe how being close to death brings clarity in life. And, you know, some people say, I had a near-death experience, and suddenly I became aware, dot, dot, dot. And the scriptures agree with this perspective. I was looking with another group at Ecclesiastes chapter 7 this week, and it says, It's better to go to a house of mourning than a house of feasting, for death is the destiny of everyone, and the living should take it to heart. So it's saying what we, I guess many of us discover, that death is a great teacher, and it shows us what we need to discover. I can actually think in my own experience of a couple of times where going to funerals has had a huge lasting impact on me. Once I was at a funeral of a university friend, and it wasn't her. I went with her to the funeral of her mother, and her father was a very rich man. He was the chairman of a bank, and the people who were attending the funeral were the great and the good, and many of them had got there by helicopter or private jet, and it was very, very powerful to be in that environment, a body in a coffin in the middle of the room, and very, very important people all around it. And it just made it very clear of how useless wealth is, and plastic surgery and health plans and private gyms. None of this makes a jot of difference when in the face of death. And that was a very powerful and visual message that was being declared that day. Or I think of another funeral more recently, another friend of mine from university, Kieran, who's a vicar in North London. His wife died, leaving two small children. And I went to the service, and afterwards, my friend Kieran, I went and gave him a big hug, and he looked me in the eye and said, "Andrew, this is why we need to tell people about Jesus and the hope that he offers." And it just knocked me for six, because even in that terrible month that he was experiencing, it had given him like a real clarity, and he wanted to pass that on to others. So death does bring clarity. Interestingly, this is part of why, you may know, in this country there was a tradition of having skulls on desks, and lots of people would do it, and it was in order to teach us the mortality and frailty of life, and to keep it an ever-present reality so we never go far from it. Actually, as a medical student, I did this as well, put it on the desk amongst the books. It was kind of being pretentious, really, and I thought it made me, you know, interesting. Sadly, I had to eventually pass on the skull to a more needy medical student in a year below, so I don't do it anymore. One way that death brings clarity is that it clears away the distractions, the things that don't matter, and it focuses us in on what matters, what it's worth living for. And in the passage today, death brings that kind of clarity to Abraham and his life. Because in the face of his wife Sarah's death, Abraham responds in a way that really has been typical of him throughout his whole life as a believer, but death brings it into focus. And Abraham, in this passage, he provides a wonderful pattern for all believers. Because Abraham shows us, and this is it on your sheets, that especially in the face of death, we're to proclaim that our true home is not here, but beyond this life. And this passage really is a one-pointer. It reinforces this central point to us in a number of different ways. So, after mourning for his wife in verse 2, we read in verse 3, Abraham rose up from before his dead and said to the Hittites, they're the people of the land, the Canaanites, "I am a sojourner and foreigner among you." It's like saying, "I'm an exile, I don't really belong here." And Abraham's opening words here have a huge weight of theological freight, huge biblical significance to them. And they are actually describe Abraham's whole outlook on life. In fact, this phrase that Abraham says here is picked up later in the Bible in Hebrews 11, where it says, Abraham and co. admitted that they were foreigners and strangers on the earth. It's interesting there, it doesn't just say in Canaan, but they were foreigners and strangers on the earth. I guess nearly all of us in this room are Londoners. How long would you say you have to live in London before you say, "I'm a Londoner"? I don't know what the rule is. Would you say a week? A year? When do you say, "Yeah, I'm a Londoner"? And I think it varies on the place a little bit. So my parents have been living in a rural village for over 50 years, and I think they're just about at that stage, you know, where those others who are part of the village since the Middle Ages kind of see them as part of the furniture now. They are now in the village. And Abraham has been living in this land of Canaan for over 60 years. So we can do the math, can't we? Sarah was 65, Abraham was 75 when they left Babylon, and she's just died, verse 1 said, age 127. So this is, you know, 60 plus years, and Abraham still calls himself a sojourner, a stranger in that place, someone who has no permanent home. He's just passing through. But actually, this has been a deliberate policy on Abraham's part. Right until the end of Abraham's life, he's determined always to live in tents, not to settle. Not because he prefers camping, there's no sense that he enjoys this life, but because, as Hebrews 11 puts it, he was looking forward to the city that has foundations, whose designer and builder is God. So Abraham's living arrangements were deliberate. They were a statement about who he was. And they were a declaration to the world of that where he was living was not his true home. There was actually a moment, we've been looking at Genesis for some time in little chunks, and there was a moment in chapter 14 when Abraham nearly, where he could have used force to cement his dominance over a large portion of the land. But as we saw then, he chose instead to trust God and God's timing, because he knew that God would fulfill the promise of the land in his way and in his time. And then the Lord explicitly told Abraham in chapter 15 that the fulfillment of God's promise of the land was still a long way off. In fact, he was told that his family were going to be sojourners in another land for over 400 years, that was Egypt, before God would finally judge and drive out the Canaanites and grant the land to Abraham's family. And so Abraham knew that his whole life was going to be marked by patient faith. His life was going to be a life of waiting for God to fulfill his promise and knowing that he had precious little to show for it. And of course now, this moment, Sarah's death would have brought the reality of this calling home to him very powerfully. I don't know what they used to dream together when they were younger, a young couple, Abraham and Sarah. There was that moment in chapter 13. The Lord promised them, "All the land that you see, I will give to you and to your offspring forever." And at that moment, you know, this is the Lion King moment, isn't it? You know, Mufasa takes his young son Simba to the top of Pride Rock and he says, "Everything the light touches is our kingdom. One day the sun will rise and all this will be yours." And perhaps they thought, you know, in their younger days, "Oh, I can't wait." And they pictured themselves, you know, enjoying their retirement together, sitting under a vine with their G&T or whatever they drank, out on the veranda of the villa, overlooking the orchards, the grandchildren playing all around them. And that was what they were looking forward to. And of course, none of that materialized. In fact, Hebrews 11 summarizes it. We had this in our congregational reading. "These all died in faith," like Sarah, "not having received the things promised." Think about Sarah's life, a life of pain, painful waiting. It was 25 years between God's promise of a seed and finally Isaac being born to her, age 90. A lot of waiting in that 25 years. And then when she died, Isaac was 37 years old and still single. And there was not a grandchild in sight, let alone a villa that they could call their own. This was Sarah's life. She never saw what was promised, never received it. And so Sarah's whole life, living in tents, painful waiting, her whole life proclaimed this reality that this is not our home. And so now at the end of her life, Abraham wants to say loudly and clearly and publicly, the only reality that makes sense of Sarah's life, the only reality that makes sense of any believer's life, really, is that our true home is beyond this life. And that is why in this chapter, Abraham goes against his normal tents-only policy. And he decides to do something striking, and he buys his first piece of real estate in the promised land. And yet we know, as we've just read, it's a property not for himself, but for Sarah's bones. So pick up from verse 4 again. "I am a sojourner and foreigner among you. Give me property among you for a burying place, that I may bury my dead out of my sight." This is a bit of a weird change of policy for him. We're scratching our heads. But he's declaring his hope in that day when Sarah will be raised from the dead. It's interesting. Some people assume, don't they, that back in the Old Testament, that the believers then were focused entirely on the here and now, on this life blessings, like the land. But now we in the New Covenant, you know, we realize it was all a metaphor and we understand eternal life and so on. But actually, even then, and Hebrews 11 has confirmed this, they knew that their real hope was beyond death. And actually, Abraham's purchase of Sarah's tomb in the land proclaims his hope. Abraham is saying God will one day fulfill this promise. And actually, when he does, it won't simply be a patch of real estate. When the promise is fully realized, it will be a new Eden. It will be a city with foundations. It will be a place where God's people like Sarah will be resurrected. That's why it's so important that her bones are there, ready to be sprung up again, to enjoy a physical, unending life in God's presence. And when we get to the New Testament and Jesus himself confirms and expands this hope, you'll remember in the Sermon on the Mount, he says, one day the meek, the true people of God, will inherit not just the land, actually, but the whole earth in Matthew 5. Abraham's hope is the same as our hope. And one of the puzzles when you read through this chapter is that actually we could have jumped, couldn't we, from verse 2, Sarah dies and Abraham goes in to mourn for her. We could have dropped straight down to verse 19. After this, verse 19, Abraham buried Sarah's wife in the cave of the field of Machpelah, east of Mamre, that is Hebron in the land of Canaan. The field and the cave that is in it were made over to Abraham as property for a burying place by the Hittites. That has got all, basically, the salient facts that we need for this chapter. You know, Abraham has bought a field and buried his wife. But in between, we get these 16 verses all about the negotiations for buying the field. We heard that as Jess was reading. All the details of these negotiations are here to help underline this main point about Abraham proclaiming that our true home is not here, but beyond this life. So, for example, one of the main things which is underlined, and I've put up there on the screens, is Abraham's insistence on buying the field rather than receiving it as a gift. Let me show you that in the verses. So verse 9, after Abraham specifies which place he's got his eye on, in verse 9, he picks the cave of Machpelah. That's a significant place where they were living when they received the promises in chapter 15 and 17 and 18. So it connects them to the promises of God. And then he says in verse 9, halfway through, for the full price, let Ephron give it to me. This is not Zac Efron, this is a different Efron, he lived longer ago. And Efron, who owns the cave, says in verse 11, no, I want to give it to you, I'm not going to sell it. And then in verse 13, Abraham is super insistent. He doesn't want it as a gift, he wants to pay for it. Verse 13, but if you will, hear me, I give the price of the field, accept it from me. So you see this insistence on purchase. And one of the things that's going on here is that the Hittites, who are Canaanites, they want to assimilate Abraham as one of them. Look, we're all brothers here. Sukasa mikasa, accept the gift, become one of us, join us. But Abraham is quite clear, he wants to remain separate. And behind Abraham's behavior here, it's actually in line with his consistent policy in Genesis. He doesn't want to become entangled with the Canaanites, such that he ends up, you know, gradually blending in and actually becoming one of them. If you've been with us in our Genesis series, this is, of course, what happened to Lot's family. They settled down in the community of Sodom. And in chapter 19, his family and his wife were lost. Well, they lost their identity first as God's people. And eventually they ended up remaining in Sodom rather than heeding God's warning to escape. And tragically, they ended up being judged along with the people of Sodom. And so Abraham knows he needs to keep separate from the Canaanites. The Canaanites are a people that God has declared he's going to judge in chapter 15. And so Abraham is polite and he's civil and he's engaged with them. but he's also crystal clear that he is going to remain separate. And we're going to see that underlined in the next chapter as well, when Abraham is clear that his son Isaac must not intermarry with these Canaanites. Now, it's interesting how these Hittites, these Canaanites, relate to Abraham. Look in verse 6. They're actually very positive. And they tell Abraham, "You are a prince of God among us. Come on in, Abraham. We know you. We respect you." But crucially, Abraham is not swayed by their warm words. And he's careful not to come into their debt and under their influence. And I think it's just worth being aware of that temptation for us. Someone has helpfully said, a kick from the world does believers less harm than a kiss. A kick gives you less harm than a kiss. One of our great dangers spiritually is being treated well by the world around us. And of course, it's very flattering, isn't it? When a senior person comes, you know, you're at work and they put their hand on your shoulder and they say, "Do you know, you could do very well here." Now, what they don't say out loud is the next line. But the next line is, "You could do very well here if..." You could do very well here if you toe the line. You could do very well here if you make sure your faith stays locked up in your private life, or whatever it is. And I was talking to someone who works at Canary Wharf a while back, who had just been promoted, and he described how much harder it was now for him to be distinctively Christian, because the company's expectations on him to be a certain way had actually just increased when he got the promotion. And now he felt he had much more to lose as well. Nothing had been said out loud. He just knew the temptation to conform had just clicked up one notch. And of course, this separateness is part of what it means to proclaim that our true home is not here. This is always the responsibility, what the calling of believers. In John's Gospel, chapter 17, Jesus describes his disciples as being in the world, chapter 17:11, but not of the world, chapter 17:14. That's a useful distinction. In the world, not of the world. And the Bible's call on us is not to withdraw and to become a Christian ghetto, but neither is the Christian to so immerse themselves in the world that we just blend in with those around us. I think a good summary of this teaching is from Peter, where he says, "Live such good lives among the pagans." And I guess we need to hear both halves of the statement. And some of us, we need to hear, "Live such good lives." Perhaps that's God's word to us this morning. Don't blend in. Be obviously different from those around you in every way that Jesus calls us to be different. Be salt and light, even when that means being labeled. And some of us need the second half of the verse, among the pagans. Don't just withdraw. Don't form a holy huddle away from those who desperately need the truth. For some of us, and I'd include myself amongst this, when Andrew was giving the notices last week about how to get ready for Skeptics Guide, and he was saying, you know, think about the kinds of events that your neighbours and friends might like to come to. And some of us were thinking, look, I don't even know my neighbours or my community well enough to know how to answer that question. And if that's us, then we need to listen to the second half of the verse. Live such good lives among the pagans. Get out there, be embedded in your community. So, one of the things underlined in the negotiations we've seen is Abraham's insistence on buying the field. And perhaps the other major thing which is underlined in those negotiations is this: Abraham's insistence on witnesses to the purchase. And there's this phrase, "in the hearing of the Hittites," or "in your presence," or "in your sight," that keeps coming through. I think it's six times in this passage. For example, in verse 9, Abraham says to the elders, "Let Ephron give it to me in your presence." Do you see what's happening? It's very important this transaction is properly witnessed by the elders at the gate. In that kind of society, this would be the equivalent of having it documented down at City Hall or wherever. And perhaps the major reason why there's such an emphasis on the purchase being witnessed and then recorded here in Genesis 23 is because this is to be a lasting memorial. Sometimes you see a war memorial and it has these words on it, "lest we forget." And the people who erected that statue, the point is they want it to be a permanent and lasting message for every future generation. These people fought for your freedom. Don't ever forget it. And in the same way, Abraham is committed to letting every future generation know this is what Abraham and Sarah, this is what Sarah and I stood for. Yes, Sarah's life may have been disappointing in a whole range of respects. Yes, many of her childhood dreams went unfulfilled. But there is one thing that makes sense of her life and my life, and it's this. God has made a promise, and we have lived and died trusting he will deliver on it. And Abraham's intention that this would be a lasting memorial is exactly what happened. This tomb here in Machpelah, or Hebron, that's probably a more famous word. You've heard the word Hebron. It's there mentioned as Hebron in verse 2 and verse 19. This tomb became the flag in the ground. It became the lasting declaration to the world that God's promise will be fulfilled. And in two chapters' time, Abraham also, he gets buried in the same tomb. He adds his signature to the declaration. God will keep his promise. And then Isaac, then Rebekah, they do the same when they're buried. Then Leah. And then the book of Genesis ends, first with Jacob and then with Joseph in the final chapter. Both of them actually far from home in the land of Egypt. But as they're on their deathbeds, they charge their children and they say, "You must bury us in Abraham and Sarah's cave. Their hope is our hope." And so one by one, each of these heroes basically adds their signature to the same declaration. God will keep his promise. We will one day be raised eternally. In fact, out of all the things that Joseph does in his life, and he has an amazing life and an amazing Technicolor dream coat, but just think of this guy's life. I mean, it's no surprise that there are musicals and stories told about it. He goes from being slave to being sovereign over the superpower of the day. He goes from prison to palace. There's so much that you could talk about and celebrate in Joseph's life. But of everything that Joseph does, there is one thing, only one thing mentioned about him in Hebrews 11. And it says this: "By faith, Joseph, at the end of his life, made mention of the exodus of the Israelites and gave directions concerning his bones." What did he do in his life? Well, this is what he did. He died as he lived, by faith. And like those before him, he declared his confidence: "This is what makes sense of my life. God will keep his promise. And I want my bones in Abraham's tomb so that everyone can know what I'm about. This is where my true hope lies, the resurrection." And actually, as you read on in the Bible, in the book of Exodus, chapter 13, sure enough, as Moses is fleeing from Pharaoh after the 10th plague of the Passover, put yourself in Moses' sandals, you know, there's a lot on his to-do list that day. What's he got to do? He's got to pack. He's got to lead 2 million refugees out into the desert on the run from a bloodthirsty tyrant. You know, the guy's got quite a lot on his mind. And Exodus 13 says that amongst all the things on his to-do list that day, he made sure that he took the 400-year-old bones of Joseph in a box with him on that journey. This was crucial. You see, Abraham's intention was that this tomb was going to be the lasting memorial for future generations. This tomb would be the defiant proclamation of hope for the people of God. And that's why we've heard the word Hebron. It's the second most revered site in the Holy Land. And still today, Sarah's tomb is still proclaiming this same message for those who have ears to hear it. God will keep his promise. Abraham and Sarah will be resurrected, and they will inherit not just the land, but the whole earth like Jesus said, and be resurrected on it. I love the story about the early Christians, despite the fact that everyone in those days used to count the year by the Roman dating system. The Christians defiantly dated the deaths of their martyrs by counting the number of years since Jesus, let's say 300, and then adding, on their tombs, Regnante Jesu Christo, in the reign of Jesus Christ. Now that is defiance. It's almost comical when you think about their situation. These downtrodden Christians getting martyred left, right and centre, and they were defiantly declaring that the true king is Jesus Christ. He is reigning today, and therefore he will resurrect his people at the end, and we will count our dating system accordingly. It's that kind of defiant hope Abraham is declaring in this chapter. I'm just going to make a little sidebar here. I debated with Andrew whether to talk about this. It's not something that I've heard a lot talked about in church, but it is a topic that is raised in this chapter. And the reason I'm a bit nervous, I don't think it's the major thing this chapter is about, but it is, the question is raised, and that is about burial. So let's have a think about this for a moment. Before Christianity came to this country, I'm told that cremation was the main way of disposing of bodies. This was the normal practice for Vikings. They believed that the smoke might help carry the dead person's spirit to an afterlife. It was the normal practice for the Romans. They believed that cremation freed their spirits from the prison of this physical world. But then with the spread of Christianity in this country, cremation disappeared. And it was replaced everywhere by burial. And that's why, in this country, wherever you go, it is filled with graveyards. Every village, every town, every city has scenes like this. And this is because the New Testament teaches that dead bodies are seeds. For example, 1 Corinthians 15, our bodies are sown perishable and raised imperishable, like seeds. And therefore, Christians plant dead bodies until such time as they're ready to sprout to new life. That's, of course, why springtime is so exciting for Christians, isn't it? We've just dished out daffodils. But for the Christian, when we see, the crocuses or the daffodils pop up, it's not just a nice flower. For us, each one of them proclaims the Easter message. Yes, we too are going to go down into the ground, but we will come up again, more glorious than before. And every daffodil reminds us of what is going to happen to us. And I guess we know, in this country that is not all there is to say, because something changed. And then at the end of the 19th century, in the Victorian era, there was a movement to reintroduce cremation. And it was a hygiene, it was to combat disease partly to reduce funeral costs, and partly, I think, to protect mourners from having to stand outside in the rain, apparently. And the movement grew. And the first crematorium in this country was in 1879 in Woking. And today, over 75% of us are getting burned now when we die. Now, I'm not trying to suggest that burial is necessary for us to be raised again. In fact, far from it. Revelation 20 says that at the final judgment, we're told even the sea gave up the dead that were in it. God is very able to resurrect us, whatever has happened to our bodies. We can trust him in that. And neither am I saying that it's necessary for all Christians everywhere to proclaim their hope in this way. But what I am just gently saying is that all things being equal, symbolically, burial is very powerful. It's a very fitting symbol for the Christian, much more so than cremation, in proclaiming what is the Christian's hope. And it's just a strange thing, isn't it, that all our forebears in this country understood that, and we seem to have forgotten it. And there aren't many passages in the Bible which, touch on this topic. We won't talk about it a whole lot. But it is something that this passage raises for us, and so I thought I'd comment on it. So, sidebar over, and now we're back onto the main thing. So, let's conclude. And we have a whole chapter of the Bible here, and we've spent quite a long time thinking about the purchase of a tomb. It's quite strange, isn't it? But it's because this purchase reveals how believers are to respond to death. And in particular, we've discovered we're to express what should be true of us all the time. Try and proclaim that our true home is not here, but beyond this life. I just want to make the point, this is not a call for us to detach from this world. I think that's what people hear Christians saying. You know, the criticism is, you guys become so heavenly minded that you're of no earthly good. In fact, exactly the opposite is true. Biblical hope always produces active engagement. C.S. Lewis said, if you read history, you will find that the Christians who did most for the present world were just those Christians who thought most of the next. And I guess he had in mind a folk like Lord Shaftesbury or William Wilberforce or Elizabeth Fry, people whose reforms have impacted not just this nation but the whole world. You see, the fact that Christians live knowing that their true home is beyond this life frees us to live uniquely radical, generous, sacrificial lives. The best example I know of this, and I love this example, is how the Christians in the Roman Empire at the time of the plagues, that back in the 2nd and 3rd centuries, lived out this reality. And there were really horrific plagues in those days, much worse than COVID. And in the course of about 100 years, about a third of the population of the empire was wiped out. And because they were so contagious, the rich just left the cities in droves, including the doctors. And they often left their own family members behind if they'd got sick. But strangely, and this is very well documented, the Christians stayed. And they cared not only for their own sick, but also for those who had been abandoned. And as a result, lots of the Christians died. And the question the historians are always wrestling with is why? You know, what made these people act so strangely? Why did they stay? And the answer is pretty obvious. It's because they knew this truth. They knew that our true home is not here. It is beyond this life. And say they, those people knew that the worst that death could do to them was just to bring that hope closer. And of course, the pagans at the time didn't have any hope of that. Famously, John Lennon's song, Imagine, in the song he tells us to imagine all the people living for today. And, you know, it's sung so nicely, it sounds very attractive. But we don't have to imagine it. We can see it with the pagans in the Roman Empire, and it is very ugly. If today is all I've got, why on earth should I give generously or live sacrificially for another person? It's illogical. If this life is all there is, you know, YOLO, you only live once, then someone might happen to be sacrificial, but they will do it in spite of their core beliefs. But you see, as believers, this hope frees us. And it enables Christians to be a different kind of humanity. It enables us to live sacrificially and radically. We don't have to go around visiting every beauty spot in the world or have every possible experience on offer. We don't have to spend our lives trying to pursue that perfect house, that perfect wardrobe, that perfect family, that perfect life, as if this life is all there is. The Christian is freed from all that. And we can start living differently and radically for Jesus and for our fellow man. And so I want to finish today by asking just one question, really. It's on the sheets as a coffee question. It'd be good for us to be discussing this question. It's a question about whether we share Abraham's hope. And here's the question. Is there anything in, insert yourself, in my life? Is there anything in my choices? Is there anything in my use of money, my use of time, in my use of energy? Is there anything in my life which is incomprehensible to those around me? You know, I'm like a tent dweller buying a tomb. No one would get it. Is there anything incomprehensible which would only make sense in the light of eternity? Is there anything in my life that shows that I have the faith of Abraham? And what might it look like if we really did share Abraham's hope? I'd love us to have a time of quiet now and to think through this passage, think through what the Lord is calling us to. And maybe just to ask God's Spirit to be putting his finger on what would it look like for me to live an incomprehensible life except for the resurrection, making sense of it. So let's have a time of quiet and then we'll have our prayers in a minute.